To protect and to serve is a standard police motto. But is that where we should be looking for protection and service? In many ways, citizens have delegated their responsibility toward their neighbors. We'll discuss the consequences of that action. Welcome to The Conquering Truth. I'm Dan Horn.
I'm Jonathan Seitz.
I'm Charles Churchill.
And I'm Joshua Horn.
So as we record this, we're in the middle of the jury deliberations about the Kyle Rittenhouse case. Kyle Rittenhouse went to an area where the Black Lives Matter were protesting, where they had looted and rioted, you know, the night before, the 2 days before. And so he went down there to protect property at allegedly at somebody's request. It seems based on the testimony that it was. But the prosecution and the liberal media is saying he's responsible for the two people that he killed and for the person he shot in the arm, even though they were chasing him, even though they were attacking him, because he provoked them by going there. The police had decided it was an area that was off limits. They weren't going to go in there. And so, therefore, for him to go there was provoking people to violence. As a nation, we've delegated the responsibility to protect life and property to the police. And so, obviously, Kyle Rittenhouse said they're not going to do something. I am. Is that proper? Should we be doing that? Is that how we should think about our responsibility to our neighbors?
You know, in America, our standard, you know, thought is if there's a problem, call the police. They're the ones who can take care of it. But we see in a lot, not just in Kenosha, but in so many cities across the country last year, that when things get bad in a city, often the police weren't getting involved. And so, you know, this responsibility that had been delegated to the police, it wasn't being fulfilled. And so there's also a question of, is it actually even going to be done by the police, even if we wanted it to be done by them? Can it be done by them?
But the police officers have to be saying that with what's been going on in the riots over the past year, that, you know, if they got caught on film shooting somebody, even if it was a legitimate shooting, they could end up in prison. They could, I mean, their life is going to be destroyed by the media. So a logical decision in that case, and they know the prosecutors in many cases are not going to back them up, it's logical for them to withdraw. But is that, I mean, that leaves a real situation of lawlessness. It's interesting that historically somebody was an outlaw when the government basically said, we're not going to give you protection of laws anymore. Now we've reversed it. When people are criminal, we outlaw the businesses around them. We outlaw the people around them. We say they no longer get protection of the law. I mean, it's a very flipped thing from what historically it's meant. And that's kind of where we are as a nation. So if you're in a place where you don't have any law, where it becomes a lawless area, then, you know, don't you kind of have to take the law in your own hands?
And I think it's, I mean, that's part of the problem is people present it as taking the law into your own hands. I mean, fundamentally, policing is a job. I mean, at the end of the day, if you're a police officer, it's something that you decided to do. It's something you're going to get paid to do. And I think if you go and look at, I mean, there have been court cases that have shown that the police cannot be held responsible. They do not have a legal obligation to do these things that people are saying they should do. And so there's this part of it where you've got something that is a job. When you think about this as Americans and the Declaration of Independence, the phrase that comes up is life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Pursuit of happiness was a fairly new phrase. The phrase before that was life, liberty, and property. And so, I mean, it's been long held that individuals have a right to these things. And that right can't be solely ensured by someone who has a job. It can't be solely ensured by someone who can't be held legally responsible for providing those things, or else it ceases to be a right. So, I mean, there is this fundamental disconnect. Because in the end, we think of these things, we say they're rights, in our most sacred documents, they're enshrined, we hold these things to be true, we say they're true, but then we go, these people who just have a job, if they don't do it, you're not allowed to. So, I mean, there's a fundamental problem there.
And I mean, the court case you were referring to and was the Supreme Court case of DeShaney versus Winnebago County. And in this, the argument was the police failed to protect the property, so therefore the police could be sued for the property. The Supreme Court said the clause, meaning the Fourth Amendment, is phrased as a limitation on states' power to act, not as a guarantee of certain minimal levels of safety and security. While it forbids the state itself to deprive individuals of life, liberty, and property without the due process of law, its language cannot fairly be read to impose an affirmative obligation on the state to ensure those interests do not come to harm through other means. Meaning, basically, the state can choose to help. They can choose to protect property. They can choose to do these things. But in the end, they don't have any legal obligation to do that. There's no forcing them to do that.
Right. Like, you know, there's the – I think it was the Parkland school shooting a few years ago where they – you know, the police get called, somebody's shooting at the school, and then the guy hangs out in his car for, you know, 15 minutes while the shooting proceeds. And while, you know, not a great police officer, and I think, you know, he eventually gets fired, but it's not like he's committing a crime or anything like that. You know, he's doing something that, you know, probably most police officers would say, no, that's not what you're supposed to be doing. But in the end, he didn't have any legal responsibility to actually do anything in that situation.
Right. All he did, as Charles was saying, all he did was fail to do his job, which is worthy of being fired. And that's what he received. It's not like there's really anything right. that he failed to do beyond that. He didn't do his job. And the idea that you should risk your life to do your job, well, people are going to go, I don't want to in that situation.
I mean, in scripture, there's a concept where it talks about the difference between a hireling and a person who actually, you know, when you're dealing with sheep and shepherds, there are people who are brought in to help take care of the sheep, and then there are the people who own the sheep and who their very life and their livelihood depends on them. Whenever somebody attacks, when bandits attack, when an animal attacks, the hireling says, you know what, it's not worth my life, and he runs. And the person whose life is actually invested in it, he says, this is my life, and he stays. And so this isn't a new concept. But it's something that we've tried to divorce from our thinking. We've tried to say that, I mean, you can delegate responsibility to other people. You can't delegate the keeping of your rights to other people.
And the point here isn't to bash the police and say all the police are cowards. I mean, we could find hundreds of examples of heroic police officers.
Yes.
We can find many examples of them, you know, laying down their lives, sacrificing their lives. The question is the responsibility of the people, the responsibility of the police. You know, what are the biblical parameters there?
And I mean, on that note, I mean, it's a pretty common motto for police departments to say that they're there to protect and to serve. But what I've heard us talking about right now is that first part, to protect. Well, I mean, according to the Supreme Court, it's actually they're not obligated to do that, by at least not by force of law. My interpretation, using semi-technical language, is that the Supreme Court is saying that the Constitution provides negative rights, meaning you have a right not to have these things infringed against.
By the state.
That the state is not going to come after your life, your liberty, your property. But
without due process. That's also because they do all those things. They just do it with due process.
What the Supreme Court at one time said, the Constitution said at one time, with all those qualifiers. But what they're also saying is that there's no positive obligation on the state to actually be protecting those things for you. So the state is not responsible to make sure that your life is preserved, that your property is preserved, that your liberty is preserved. It's just they're not supposed to be coming after those things.
You know, we talk about the police walking away if it's too dangerous. And, I mean, it's important for us to recognize these are just people. And because they're just people, there are cases where they might have, you know, more sympathy towards the person that's attacking rather than the person. I mean, it gets involved in all kinds of other things that are real things. And so, you know, as Joshua was saying, we're not trying to beat up on the police, but we also shouldn't hold them. You know, our society is built with so much hero worship and stuff that you go, oh, the police, look what heroes they are. Well, no, they're normal people. And some of them are very heroic and some of them are very cowardly. And they're made up of a group of people that have all kinds of different traits. So to rest on that just because they went through an academy and say, therefore, they will protect me, that's not usually what they're there to do. And usually, if something is happening, they won't get there until well after it happened. Somebody's stealing from your house, if you go, well, I'll call the police, they'll be long gone before the police get there. And so that's not even a way to protect property, and life is even worse. If they're about to shoot you, the police, calling the police is not going to do anything because they'll be there long after you're dead in most cases.
Right. I mean, there's all kinds of stories of, you know, somebody gets their stuff stolen. And I think I've even known people this has happened to. And then they go on Craigslist and they find their stuff. And then they call the police. And the police are like, eh, okay, well, not really interested in doing anything about that. And, you know, even cases where it seems like it's their job description, they won't do anything about it. And the way our system is set up, you can't really do anything about it either.
And more importantly than even their job description, it's the biblical description of what the state is supposed to do. They're supposed to punish evildoers. It's not that they're supposed to catch evildoers. They're supposed to punish evildoers. That's the purpose of the state. That's why they're given the sword. So when you come and say, this person stole, here they're selling my property that I can prove, I have the serial numbers, whatever, and the police, and I know of a case like that too, where the police are kind of like, yeah, whatever. Well, no, that's actually what they should be doing, but we've got it now that they should be patrolling the neighborhood, that they should be, you know, trying to build relationships with the community. They have all these other things that they're doing, but their actual biblical responsibility of the state is to punish evildoers.
I think, you know, there's probably a perspective that the average American has is that, you know, police, how else could you even set up a system without police, without prosecutors, without all these things? But, you know, in a lot of ways, the police are a relatively modern invention. You know, only a few hundred years do you have the modern police force. I mean, before that, you do have sheriffs and things of that nature, and you do have, you know, government officials, but the people doing the day-to-day work of what we would call policing, there were no police officers in those jobs. You know, the people going out and apprehending people and, you know, all these things, there was no police force to do those things. Those things were handled by the citizens.
And there was an expectation that there was a responsibility. If you saw someone being robbed, you were expected to try to apprehend the person who was stolen from. I mean, I think if you go back, I want to say it was the Statute of Winchester, 1285, that it was encoded in the Statute of Winchester that, you know, if a person robbed someone, then up to 100 men would need to pursue that individual until they were caught and they were brought to justice. And it was just more if you saw it, if you were in the area, that it was your job to chase that person down and bring them back. And there was this part of it where, I mean, it tied your responsibility together as a community. If you were out there and some kid stole something and you had to stop what you were doing and go and chase him down, you would go to his parents and go, what are you doing? This is the third time this week that I've had to leave my work and I've had to go and chase this individual down. And so it fundamentally changed the connection between this thing that's going on in your community, you, what it cost you, whose responsibility it was to deal with it. And we've pushed all those things out. Now they're dealt with by paid professionals who walk around with a gun on their hip. And if they get involved, I mean, things have actually usually progressed to a point where they've gotten bad enough that the police have to be called, as opposed to things getting stopped much, much earlier.
Or you're literally bringing a gun to a fistfight.
Right.
Right. I mean, that's literally what's happening, because when the police officer comes, and I'm not saying if you had that job that doesn't make perfect sense to do, but you're going to come armed. You're going to come armed with a gun. And that inherently has escalation aspects to it,
right,
that make it harder to de-escalate the situation. And I do think that, you know, to go back to the biblical foundations, we need to just remember the first crime in the Bible, right? I mean, the first crime in the Bible is Cain kills Abel. God confronts Cain. He says in Genesis 4:9, then the Lord said to Cain, where is Abel, your brother? He said, being Cain, I do not know. Am I my brother's keeper? And the answer is Cain was in rebellion to God, so he answered no. God asked him, treating him as if, yes, you are your brother's keeper. And so in that case, there's no question what the right answer was, and it's not the answer Cain gave, but it's the answer most Americans would give, is no, we've delegated that to the police. Am I supposed to be my brother's keeper? Why would I stop that person from breaking into his house next door? And I think we've just got this we've adopted as a society the position of Cain, and that's a really dangerous position to have.
Can you break that down a bit? I mean, what type of responsibilities are you talking about? Especially, you know, because there's two sides to this. The one is, if you're creating a civilization from scratch, how would you create it? And the other side is, in modern America, where our laws are the way they are, and none of us are in a position to rewrite the laws, how should we act in our modern state?
It reminds me of when you see a problem that seems really intractable, and people just sit down and go, there's nothing that can be done. And there's another set of people who go, let's just start working on it. And what's amazing is frequently the people who just start working on it is very quickly the problem becomes smaller and starts to be solved. I mean, there are people who walk, you know, you've seen people walk into a room where like everything is just absolutely trashed. And you've seen kids do this where the room is just trashed and the kid just walks in and he just sits down and he gives up before he even starts. And it takes 3 hours. It takes three, and I understand society is going to take more than 3 hours, but what I mean is there is this fundamental attitude of going, I don't understand how any of this can be solved. And God literally is sitting there going, are you going to come to me? Are you going to choose, you know, are you going to look to me for answers? And God actually blesses those things. And I think there is this part of it where if the church goes, this problem can't be solved, they're not treating God as God. They're not treating the one who created the universe the way he should be treated. He can unravel complex problems. And so the real question is what do we do? But it's not, how could you solve this? How can this be fixed? That really even shouldn't be part of the question.
And I think when you go to Isaiah 1, where it talks about, you know, God is judging Israel, and he's judging Judah, and he's saying, I'm going to destroy you as nations. You think you're worshiping me and you're not, because you don't care about the widow, you don't care about the orphan. You know, in Isaiah 1:17 it says, learn to do good, seek justice, rebuke the oppressor, defend the fatherless, plead for the widow. In seek justice, it seems to me that like stopping somebody from breaking into your neighbor's house is seeking justice. Rebuking the oppressor, that's a lot of what, you know, you have a man beating up his wife, that's an oppressor. And you're supposed to do something about it. And God isn't saying this to the leaders of the society. He's saying this to everybody. So I agree completely with what you were saying, but we also need to understand this isn't just like, yeah, we should do this. This is like God judges societies if you don't do this.
Right.
And so it's really easy for us to say, yeah, we're going to delegate all this. And God says, you're accountable. You're responsible. You need to do this. And the church in particular needs to be doing this instead of just saying, well, it's such a hard problem. How will we deal with it?
I think a lot of it, when you look at, and I do think part of it is what we think of as a modern society, a lot of it is built on top of unbiblical ideas. What we think of as being, I mean, you think back and like people will talk about how, you know, people used to be nosy neighbors. And I understand there can be people who go too far, but there was a part of it where when people moved in, people went and met them. They wanted to know who their neighbors were, because who their neighbors were actually mattered. These, you know, I mean,
and that, who their neighbors are still really matters,
right? And there's this attitude that you shouldn't worry about your neighbors, and really one of the reasons why people say you shouldn't worry about your neighbor is they don't want anybody bothering them. They don't want anybody questioning what they're doing. They don't want anybody asking, why are you doing that? They don't, you know what I mean? But we do depend on each other. We really do. And so there's this part of it where we're starting to inherit the problems that have been caused by us saying it doesn't matter who your neighbor is. Because we find out, you know, in Kenosha, it really did matter who your neighbor was. It mattered a great deal. It mattered the way they thought about things. It mattered whether they would actually stand with you and keep rioters away. I mean, all these things start to really, really matter. And the attitude is we shouldn't do these things, but God's word says we should. And I mean, when you look back at the history of America, a lot of the incidentals of our society, a lot of the little things that made it up were built on the idea that we did have responsibility for one another.
I think, you know, kind of to loop back to, well, what you just mentioned, you know, where people are going, we're going to stop the rioters from destroying our city. You know, I think that's a, you know, that is, I think, is an example of this. But there's also, you know, kind of a positive side to that, too, is, you know, being prepared to serve your community. There's a podcast I listen to occasionally from T-Rex Arms. It's like a gun accessories company. So they're talking about these things like, you know, are you prepared to defend your city? These things. But one point that they made that they make pretty interesting is that, you know, you might think, am I ready in this, you know, apocalyptic situation to, you know, beat off looters? Well, step back. Are you ready also to serve your community? Are you preparing to actually go out and help people? You know, if something, if there's a disaster, are you not just focused on yourself, but focus on others so that you, it's not just about stopping evil, but also promoting good.
Right.
Right. We need to learn to do good. And I mean, you, when Christ talks about it, it in Luke 10, he's saying, you know, this is who's responsible. You are responsible for your neighbor. Then Jesus answered and said, a certain man went down from Jerusalem to Jericho and fell among thieves, who stripped him of his clothing, wounded him, and departed, leaving him half dead. Now by chance, a certain priest came down that road. And when he saw him, he passed by on the other side. Likewise, a Levite, when he arrived at the place, came and looked and passed by on the other side. But a certain Samaritan, as he journeyed, came where he was. And when he saw him, he had compassion. So he went to him, bandaged his wounds, pouring on oil and wine, and he set him on his own animal, brought him to an inn, and took care of him. On the next day, when he departed, he took out 2 denarii, gave them to the innkeeper, and said to him, take care of him, and whatever more you spend, when I come again, I will repay you. So which of these three do you think was neighbor to him who fell among the thieves? And just like the issue with Cain, I mean, God, Christ in this case, is clearly showing we're supposed to help in those situations. We're not just supposed to walk by. Now what we'd say is you should call the police. This person was beaten up. He was robbed. He was stabbed.
He was in an area where there were robbers, where there were
bandits.
It was
a dangerous place.
For people, to go.
People should have called the police. And that's not what Christ says. Christ says you should care for them. You should take care of them. You should serve them.
Last year, we heard a lot of people calling for defund the police. You know, we don't need the police officers going out there to do the things that they're doing. You know, we don't need the police officers. We just need, you know, mental health professionals to go deal with people. And you know, we're kind of, you know, those are that's coming from the left. But now we're kind of intersecting with that a bit, which is that, you know, a lot of situations that police go out to, not that we should replace police officers with mental health professionals, but those situations are not best handled by the police, and they're best handled by other people.
One of the things is that, you know, what is the police's role? When we think of it to serve and to protect, we usually think of it to direct traffic if there's an accident, to help somebody if they break down by the side of the road, to arrest somebody if they're stealing, I was looking today at what the Raleigh, North Carolina, since that's the biggest city we're close to, what the mission statement is of their police department. And it says, in the spirit of service, the Raleigh Police Department exists to preserve and improve the quality of life, instill peace, and protect property through unwavering attention to our duties in partnership with the community. That isn't like just arresting people. What they're trying to do is to make police into social workers. They're trying to say that it's to improve the quality of life. That's very, very, very far from what God gave the sword to the state to do.
I mean, it seems it's kind of left out arresting people. Like, it kind of falls
protect
under
property?
There. But,
I mean,
like,
it doesn't even say to protect life. It's just to protect property.
And what about enforce the laws?
It's just preserve life.
Yes. No, preserve and improve the quality of life, not life.
Right, but I guess there would be a fundamental difference there, even though there is. I mean, and I think it does work its way down.
Well, I think to preserve and improve the quality of life certainly has a broader application than just protecting life.
Right.
It's that their job is to make people's lives better. And I don't know that that's even what people think that they've delegated to the police.
I mean, the problem is, this kind of goes back to the point we were making earlier where we said the point of this really isn't to bash the police, because I honestly think most of what the police are doing, they have been asked to do, or it is a necessary consequence of what they've been asked to do. How much time do parents have with their children? The amount of time that they're spent at school, the amount of time in their life, the amount of time they're in their room playing video games, they're watching TV. And so there's this part of it where even raising children has fallen to other people. So, I mean, by the time your child gets to a certain point, the likelihood that they're going to come in contact with a police officer, and the police officer is going to say, I'm going to have to deal with this person who really hasn't had that much training, hasn't had that much involvement by his parents. So if you're a police officer, there's this part of it where you're going, I should expect this is what I have to deal with. This is the world you've dealt me. And you're asking me, you don't want to deal with problems. That's really clear. People don't want to deal with other people's problems. I have to deal with the problems, and I have to use the tools that I have at hand are taking people into custody, shooting them, threatening to shoot them, threatening to arrest them, bringing them into court, using the court system to either, you know, detain them for periods of time, threaten to detain them. I mean, I sat in on a court case not that long in juvenile court not that long ago, and a kid came in. He had physically assaulted his mother. And so the police officers are, I mean, he's in the court and the judge is talking to him and they're like, listen, you know, we're really, and this was the tone. You got to make sure that you don't do this to your mom again. So here's what we're going to do. I mean, I know you're working really hard. I know you've been trying really hard. If you do this again, we've given her the authority. She calls us. We're going to bring you in. We're going to put you in detention and you're going to be in custody for at least 5 days. And then you go from there. And if you go back and you do it again, you'll be in custody longer. And then you'll have to, I mean, and they were late, you know, they were giving her the ability to put her son in some kind of constraint. But this was, these are the tools that they have. And so there's this part of it where when you look at what they're doing, I actually understand why they're doing what they're doing. But when you come to us and you say, is this the way, like you said, if you're building a society from scratch, who would design this?
And I mean, what I did when I read that statement, I mean, my first thought of it is exists to preserve and improve the quality of life. Well, that's really the church's responsibility.
Right.
And then you read instill peace, church's responsibility. Protect property, not as much the church's responsibility. I would argue that that's every citizen's responsibility. You know, and so an unwavering attention. We know that's the church's responsibility to have unwavering attention. But when you read these things, it's really easy to just recognize that the church is failing to do these. So we've delegated these things that are really a church function because it can actually do it in a way that's useful rather than somebody coming with a sword or, you know, in modern times with a gun to do these things. It doesn't work that well.
Right.
Or even, I mean, you know, the case you're talking about, it's a church function. It could just be a familial function.
Sure.
I mean, you know, don't know the circumstances, but my guess is there's no father there.
Right.
And so somewhere along the way, the father, you know, either something unfortunate happened and he died, or the father just abdicated. And because the father's not there doing what he should be doing with the son, you have the whole machinery in all its clunkiness of the state being what is left to deal with this boy.
Right.
That, you know, he doesn't have an actual father. He doesn't have all of the sort of substitute fathers that he could have. A pastor, a neighbor, you know, somebody else speaking into his life, not a police officer and a judge.
Right.
But in what I was saying, though, is that the state has taken that position. And in that case where there is an orphan, it's the responsibility is to the church to take care of that. When there is a widow, the responsibility is given to the church to take care of that. And now we're saying that it's the police department that's going to help with that situation. The police department's going to raise that son,
right,
whose father, you know, let's be serious, in the vast majority of the cases, the father just left. And so in that case, it's the church that should be coming alongside. It's the church that should be saying marriage, you know, people should be held accountable to their marriages. And it's the church that's supposed to be shining light into that area. And the police just don't have the ability to do that. And to expect them to be able to rectify that situation where it's already bad, it's actually the church that has the tools to do that, and the state doesn't.
I mean, part of the problem is when you say it's the church's responsibility, well, this is not the primary topic of discussion here. It's a lot of people go, so the church would pay people to do that?
The answer is no!
Because in the end, in a lot of churches, we've done exactly the same thing as is going on in the state. And I mean, I'm not trying to switch Absolutely. To that subject, but I mean, there's a part of it where we've said, God says, have deacons order the ministry of the church, not do all the work of the church, but have them order it. Have the pastor is not the only person who preaches the word of God, but he preaches it to the people, and the people are all supposed to be responsible to also preach the word of God. But we've said we're going to have professionals here. We're going to outsource this. We'll have Sunday school teachers. We'll have all, you know, and right. To the people in the pew, they're exactly the same place, you know. So now we'll just have church police, and the church police can take it over.
And we forget the purpose of the church is to edify the believers for the work of the ministry in terms of what it's supposed to do for the believers. It's supposed to be putting them in the situation where they see that young man who's going astray because his father left, and they do something. They see the robber and they do something. They see the trash on the street and they do something. They see the person injured, they do something. And that's what the church is supposed to be doing, is building up people so that they actually go and do the works of service and the works of protection too, I would argue. Because light has a lot to do with it, and just having a – you look at the patterns of crimes and – you know, I remember when you moved to Durham that you looked at the road, or when you were buying a house in Durham, you looked at the road that you were on. And obviously that neighborhood was different because there was a lot less crime there than there was just a few blocks away, because the neighborhood matters. And, you know, Joshua was making the point before, how do you reverse this? Well, you do it a neighborhood at a time. You do it by just having people know each other and having people have an expectation that other people will look out for them. And that can greatly reduce these things.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, and I hope no one is listening to this and thinks that we're proposing some type of utopian solution that's going to solve all of society's ills if you implement these five simple changes, because that's not what we're trying to say.
If we all perfectly obeyed, maybe.
Right, and it's not that, you know, it's not that if we, say, abolish all the police departments that things are going to be solved, or that even things would get better, because these are, you know, these are problems – to use a popular modern word, systemic problems through society that are, you know, everyone is having these problems. The systems are set up with these problems embedded in them where people aren't taking responsibility. And you know, you look back at, you know, we referenced early American history and even history before that, where there are no police departments. And why does that work? You look at what the founders said about the way they set up the government, and they even, like John Adams said, the Constitution was written for moral and religious people and not for any other. These type of things work when it's a moral people, which is the point that's making has to be done through the church. It's not that, you know, Turkey, which has a handful of true churches, that, oh, they just need to turn over to the church. No, because the 99.9 whatever percent of the people there are pagans, Muslims, and this, you can't turn that over to the church. But once the society was reformed and people were converted such that they would even consider handing it over to the church, then it's something that would be more actually the church could handle. So this is a very, you know, long-term fix.
And, you know, to go back to what you were starting with there, where you said we're not trying to propose some sort of utopian fix for this. We're very much acknowledging that people are sinners and that they sin, and that they sin in ways that have to be dealt with. And what we're doing is we're saying, what, you know, if you didn't have anything but your Bible, how would you deal with these things? How would you set up society to deal with those sorts of things? How would you say God defines neighbors? How would you say God delegates responsibility? How would you say God delegates authority? And start there and then say, all right, does society that we have match that? Well, no, we think it misses in some areas. And how do we get from where we are closer towards that? And it's not an overnight thing, and it's going to be a weaning off of where we are to move towards where we ought to be.
But I mean, one thing is that we should be realistic about what America looks like. The reality is you go into rural America, and yes, there's police, but it's very different than it is in cities. Right. The number of police per person is a lot different.
And what those police officers do.
Pretty much where I lived, you know, the sheriff occasionally would do stuff, but mostly they just did traffic accidents when I lived out in the country.
Occasionally.
The point is that there is already in certain communities the idea that you are supposed to – I mean, it hasn't died entirely in America, not even close to being died entirely in America. But this view is being pushed out from the cities and is moving out to the suburbs. And the church should be shining light so it moves the other direction. And so we know that it happens, and we know that it works in a lot of ways. What we're just saying is the church should be more deliberate about it. It's not that it doesn't work. We know it works.
Right. And it works in particular circumstances. And it works by changing things from the bottom up and not the top down. So on this point of this works for a certain type of people, to use a historical example. So in, the Yukon Gold Rush around 1900, that's people are coming in. There's two jurisdictions, because right on the border between Canada and Alaska, the United States. And so the government was set up very differently there. And this was the frontier of America. There was basically no law enforcement. You know, all the law enforcement was through minors meetings. It was kind of vigilante justice. I mean, they would prosecute people and hang them for particular things, but there was not some big court system. On the once you cross the Canadian border, there the Mounties were in charge, and they were, you know, running a pretty tight ship. And so the area in Canada with the police were much better run and much more orderly than the American side. And is that because police are the solution to all the problems? No. The answer is, or the reason why it worked so badly in Alaska and there was so much crime in those cities and those miner camps is because of the people coming in were not the cream of the crop of America. They were more like the dregs of America, you know, get rich quick, let's go, you know, lawless people. And so while they did try to constrain some wickedness, they did not do a good job. You bring in people from different communities, they were trained in particular ways, they are able to impose a lot more order and have a lot better run society.
I mean, it is interesting to go back as to why we have police forces in America. Most of it was from like 1825, 1835 through 1855 is when most cities established police officers. And the reason that they did it is because at that point there became more of a commercial district and a residential district. And so like if you're a port city, and you have all these ships coming in and you're offloading stuff. Before, what happened is the people who owned the ports, they had to pay people to guard their goods. And they went, wait a second, we can save money. We'll get the city to pay for our goods to be stored. And of course, they had political connections. And so the original thing for police was much more to protect goods for places where people weren't. And then it expanded out from there. In the South, a lot of times it was, especially when you start to get the abolitionist movement, and there were some people that were against slavery and stuff that escaped slaves. So the rich plantation owners, instead of paying people to hunt down the slaves, they started to create police forces to catch the runaway slaves. And so in both cases, it wasn't this general thing that was supposed to be generally applicable to everybody and that you needed to have police. It's just, as usually happens, is that when government takes on a role that it's not supposed to, what happens? It immediately starts expanding. And so now we look at it and we go, oh, yeah, they're supposed to do this and this and this and this and this. I mean, even when it started much more of a niche thing for very specific purposes and to fulfill those purposes.
And you look at if those companies in the commercial districts that were wanting a police force to protect their stuff, if those companies still exist, I would pretty much guarantee that they have private security working there because the police thing failed. You know, Walmart has loss prevention people because they can't just trust the police to stop their stuff being stolen.
And they still have security guards and they still have lock fences and they still have to go back and do all those things. But now the residential places, people that are living in residential communities, they're going, well, the police should protect us too. And it was just assumed that they would protect themselves.
Or even in the case of Walmart, what's happened is now the government says, if you want the police to be there, you have to pay for right. them. And so it was originally economic, and it's become economic again in a different way.
We've all dealt with two-year-olds, and it's a two-year-old. And still, it can get pretty ugly. Now make them a 25-year-old that's the first time they're constraining them, and it's going to look really ugly for somebody who refused to do it to the two-year-old. It's going to be shocking. And you go, how could you do that? How could you shoot him seven times? Well, he was trying to kill me.
Right.
Because he's not a two-year-old. Your two-year-old, when you're trying to get control of them and they're out of control, they would kill you, but they can't. The 25-year-old can. So the police officers are having to do things because we failed way before that. And then the people look at it and go, this is shocking. This is horrible because they didn't do it in the first place when it was easier. And so all these things are escalating because people aren't saying, we actually didn't need to do the hard work in our families, let alone the neighborhood.
I remember, I mean, I remember it coming at me many different ways as a young parent, but getting all sorts of advice of basically, if you don't teach your small children self-control, the problem is not that they aren't going to be controlled. It's that it's going to escalate to the point where somebody is going to constrain them.
Right.
And if you're not teaching them to be self-constrained, then eventually the police are going to do it.
Right. I have a friend of mine who was a former police officer. He also worked for his church. They would do a summer camp. They had a group of boys. They took him down to the campground. He came down late. He got there like 8 o'clock that night. He hadn't been with the group going down earlier that day. He was supposed to go in and make sure they were all in bed. You know, it was 8, 9 o'clock. He goes in. They're playing with flashlights. No big deal. He goes in. Guys, turn your flashlights off. One flashlight keeps staying on. So he goes over to him and he says, "You're going to need to hand me your flashlight." He reaches down to grab the flashlight. And he feels this hand grab him around the throat, like vice tight. It turns out it was a kid. He hadn't met him. He had never seen him before. 17 years old, 260 pounds, 6'3". He said he was choking him so tightly, he said he couldn't breathe. He said his kind of police training kicked in. He said he punched him in the nose. He said he's starting to fight the kid. The kid's fighting him back. The other guy, the other counselor, walks into the room, flips on the light, blood all over the place, turns the light back off, and walks out. And I mean, it ended up being the kid's dad apologized. The kid, I mean, there's all this stuff's going on. But the guy turning off the light, I mean, it's perfect metaphor.
Right. That's
it's the- this. I don't know how to deal with this situation. Click. I'm walking away because what do you do? This kid is strong enough to kill a man, and I'm not saying he was thinking, "I really want to kill a man." But he wasn't thinking I'm under control.
I should give him my flashlight.
Right. And so, you know what I mean? And it's just, I remember hearing that story and going, this applies to so many different aspects of life.
I mean, one thing that happened, right, with the Vietnam War is that all of a sudden there were movie cameras that were at the war. And all of a sudden people went, "War's like that?" Before it was nice and controlled. They'd have some, but they'd do nice little clips to show on Saturday at the movie theater rather than it being on the nightly news. And everybody went, "We don't want any involvement with war." The same thing's happening with policing, is that now there's cameras everywhere. Everybody takes a video on their phone. And we're looking at what policing's like and we're going, "We don't want any involvement with that." But the solution can't be to blame the police for what it takes to police.
Right.
It has to be people should be policing, which means to be taking care of an area. They need to be policing earlier so that the police, when it gets to the point where you're wielding the sword against who you should be wielding the sword against. But now we have so many people that need the sword wielded against them because the rod wasn't, because the keys weren't.
Right. And part of the issue here with all this police, you know, use of force and all this stuff is it's the way our system is set up, where the police are the ones that deal with the law. And actually, it's not legal for you to do what the police do because they have laws that apply only to the police. I mean, from the fact that you can't just go arrest someone who you think is doing any crime. I mean, there are certain laws that allow you to do certain things. But the citizen's arrest is a lot more restricted than the police officer's arrest. You know, from that all the way to, you know, police officers can carry weapons a lot of places that citizens can't. And, you know, their justification for using them is different. And so some of it comes down to, you know, we see force being used in certain ways, and we are not allowed to use force in that way. And in some cases, they shouldn't be allowed to either.
Right. And what we end up doing as a society is we've created two laws. We've created a set of laws for one group of people and a set of laws for the other group of people. And God calls that evil. It's evil to have partiality. It's evil to have two laws. And so we can't say this person's allowed to do this because he's allowed to use force on that person if he's jaywalking, but this other person's not allowed to. We've created this whole set of things that is actually putting police officers in really bad situations, but then we're also saying you have to go in the bad situation when everybody else is running out. So we've created a situation in our society that really is unsustainable. So one thing you said before is, how do you fix this? Well, it's going to have to be changed. It's not sustainable. It's not working.
And to kind of give a little bit of what an alternative system could look like is, you know, how things used to work is that, you know, if someone committed a crime against you, you know, then you go to the court, you get, you know, the court gives permission to, you know, call this person before the court. Sometimes it would be the sheriff that would come with other people as necessary to go arrest this person. So the citizens themselves are participating in bring this person in to the courts. And so it's not just the police officer, you know, says, what are you doing? And then he's the special guy. So if you have to do exactly what he tells you or you get arrested. It's that, you know, everyone is pretty much equal unless you actually go to the level of getting the court involved. And then things start to change.
Right, because, I mean, in our system, sheriffs are actually part of the judicial department, while the police are part of the executive branch. Judicial branch of the government. Well, police are part of the executive branch because it is related to wielding the sword is what sheriffs are supposed to do. That's why they do court orders and they do other things. But they also would, you know, traditionally you get a posse. That's where, you know, that's the idea is that you go in there and the sheriff goes, we need to arrest this guy. I think the example you said before was 100 people and 100 people were to go with him and to arrest the person. And that's how it was supposed to happen. And the state was exercising their use of the sword through the court system, which is a valid use of the sword.
Right. And so now you have these cases where, you know, it starts with something, you know, somebody uses a counterfeit $20 bill and then they end up dead. Or someone, you know, is selling cigarettes without paying the taxes and they end up dead. Well, in one sense, yeah, that's not, you know, that's not just. On the other hand, the police are following the law. And this is the job we've given them. That if someone commits a crime, it's their job to, you know, arrest them right there if they judge it appropriate. And if the person doesn't listen to them, what are they supposed to do? You know, they have to take certain actions. And you create this really difficult situation where, you know, you're giving these people that they need to handle it right now. And so things get escalated.
In some ways, what we're running into now is we're reaping the result of 60 years of kind of on the social side saying people should be able to sin in whatever way they want to. We shouldn't be able to say sexual immorality is a sin. We shouldn't be able to say the way you talk is a sin. We shouldn't be able to say the way you think and the things you want to look at are a sin. If you know, I mean, we've sold this for 60 years, and now we're meeting the grandchildren of the people who sold this. I mean, and we've been affected by it as well. But I mean, what we've said, you have to allow all these things. You have to let people do this. And then we see the result of it and we go, I can't imagine the world being different than this. This is how the world is. But the world wasn't this way before we started doing this. And so there's this part of it where, yes, it's going to take real time to put things back. But it wasn't that long ago that it was fundamentally different. It wasn't, I mean, it was in the 1960s. I think we've talked about in another episode that North Carolina recognized the Sabbath as businesses weren't allowed to be open. And so, I mean, these things, this change and the way our society has changed, it's changed really rapidly, but it's changed because the church just stepped back and said, yep, everybody can do these things and we're not going to say anything about it.
And I mean, you know, I talked about how the police forces started like in the, you know, the mid-19th century. But you look at it and the big escalation happens with Prohibition because that's where all of a sudden you get more organized crime. That's all of a sudden. And so that's when you see that explosion of the size of police departments. So when you tie that to, you know, the 30s compared to 60s, right, because it's early 60s that all the sexual revolution right. starts and all that stuff, it's not that long after the two. So there was a delegation, a huge delegation of responsibility to the police that happens in the 30s. In the 40s and the 50s. And also the people coming back from the war, they didn't want to do it. They had just gone to war.
Right.
They were more than happy to give over their responsibility to use force. Right. And so
to be parents.
All kinds of things. And so when you hit the 60s, you know, it does connect together. This right. is why all of a sudden in the 60s, and then people are shocked when, you know, Kent State, when they shoot a couple people. I mean, these things end up being very shocking to people because, but the police were delegated to solve the problem. And when you have rioters and then people back off and don't do it. And so anyway, but all these things, this is happening much more recently and they're all tied together more than we might think they are.
Right. I mean, another thing that kind of, that it reminds me of at least as well, and it kind of ties back into the beginning, the question about could Kyle Rittenhouse be there, and is what Joshua said about, you know, he said America was, the laws of America were designed for moral people, for a people who could keep these, you know, who were moral. The other way you could word it as what we're really saying you should be allowed to be is you want to be a free people or do you want to be an enslaved people? I mean, and there's this part of it where, what, you know, one side we're saying absolutely we are free and we have to be free. And then on the other hand, we're going, hey, make sure we're free. You know, I mean, we're looking at the police and going, you have to make sure we're free. And freedom doesn't work that way. At the end of the day, you are responsible for you being free. Freedom is a responsibility. And whenever you delegate sufficient amount of the responsibility, you actually lose the right to freedom as well. And I think we've lost that fundamental connection.
But I think there was a move to do that too. This isn't like just passively happening.
Right.
This, because the reality is there was a very obvious group that was free there. And there was a very obvious group that's been free in the United States over the last 18 months where they're rioting and they're burning and they create the Capitol Hill, autonomous zone. And they do all these other things where there is a group of people that the society, that the police, that the government, because they're under the pressure from voters and from political, bases and organizations, that they're saying they're free to do whatever they want. But that means other people aren't. And
right.
There has to be that trade-off. And so when the police are set up to go, well, we're not going to go into Kenosha because they're burning and looting, so we're not going to go in there. And then they're saying Kyle Rittenhouse now is not free to go in there because they've chosen to give freedom to a group of people that are inherently immoral in what they're doing. I'm not saying it because I'm saying that they're there to do immoral things, and they chose to give freedom to them. And so when you delegate it, the people you delegate it to and their rulers over them, they then decide who's free and who's not free.
Right.
And you mentioned the Chaz or whatever it was, and there there's a trial run of abolishing the police with a particular community of America, and it goes really badly. It goes horribly. Crime defined legally, biblically, common sense, morally, rampant, and they're protesting the shooting of an unarmed black person, and then like within a few weeks their volunteer vigilante enforcement choose an unarmed black person. And so you see that you need – these solutions are not for wicked people. These solutions are for people not 100% righteous, but that there are righteous people in the society. There are people whose sin is constrained and who are having an effect on others.
So, just trying to lay out some of the landscape with that, as that's helpful as a template. But if you don't want anarchy – then you're going to have some kind of constraint on sin. And the constraint is either going to be something that is self-imposed, at every level, starting at the bottom and trickling up. It's going to be self-imposed on the individual. It's going to be imposed within families. It's going to be imposed within churches and local communities, eventually up through the state. So you're either going to impose it that way, or it's going to get imposed top-down. And it's going to, there's going to be a case, where you're not going to have anything but a militarization of the police, where the police, who have mottos saying that they're going to preserve and improve the quality of life, that's a pretty big mission statement right there. And if you're dealing with the people who have no interest in constraining themselves, you're just going to have to get bigger and clunkier and more ham-fisted, and America will become a police state. Like, pick your foreign police state that you really don't like, because there's just no other way about it unless you want to constrain yourself.
And the reality is, we should at the same time, this is judgment on the one side from God, and it's mercy on the other side from God at the same time. The reason that we have this explosion of policing and everything else is because we refuse to police ourselves, and God is kind enough not to turn us over to anarchy.
Right.
So it is his wrath. It is his judgment on us as a people, because the church is not causing people to walk in a moral way. We're not shining forth the light. We know that from Romans 1. The rise of homosexuality means that they do not want to retain God in their knowledge. We're not preaching the gospel right. We're not declaring who God is right. We're not shining forth the light so that the darkness flees. And the judgment from that is the policing system that we have. And it's also a mercy of God, because it could be worse. It could be much worse.
There are much worse things than a police state.
Right. I mean, God kind of created the world so that these type of things balance each other out, where you have, and not in ways that the end state is a great state, but you have, these countries in Africa or wherever it might be that descend into civil war and anarchy. And then from that emerges a dictator who is oppressing the people, but also he is enforcing laws to a certain degree for his own benefit, for his cronies' benefit, but yet he also, in certain ways, improves the lives of enough people that he's able to remain in power. And while that's not the ideal situation, it is balancing the horrible things that were happening when you had just complete chaos everywhere.
In Daniel, it talks about how when Nebuchadnezzar conquers all the nations of the earth, basically, that they all prospered. He was the tree that all the birds, you know, and vested in its branches, and everything prospered because of him. And he was a police state, right? He says also, I hold life and death in my hands. I can kill whoever I want, whenever I want it. He was a police state, but still he caused people to prosper versus having anarchy. And versus, I mean, even this is international, what we would call international anarchy. And it causes real prosperity. So even as we talk about these things, these are things that are not saying that the state that we have is the worst state that it could be. But we are headed in a direction that is not a good direction. But the church has to repent if we want to turn the direction.
Right. And so the point isn't that, you know, we should all be advocating police state. The point is we need to recognize that the message is broad. And while in America we have a history of liberty, which is a great thing, that liberty has to be connected to self-government, self-control. And we can't just be saying, we want liberty. We want to say we want to walk righteously, love our neighbor, constrain this thing in our household, you know, fight evil wherever we can, and then that will give us a society in which liberty can work.
And all of the messaging of defund the police is just wrong, because it's saying let's throw off authority, let's throw off bonds, without saying at the same time let's recognize that people are sinners, that we are sinners, and that we've got to do something to deal with our sin and the consequences thereof.
Right.
But first thing they did was define sin so that it's not sin, right? They call evil good is how they get there in the first place. And then they say we shouldn't have any constraint on it. So the defund the police movement is contrary to everything that we're saying here, because they are basing it on homosexuality is fine, you know, drug use is fine, drunkenness is fine, revelry of any kind is fine. All these things are fine. So therefore, we need to get rid of the police because the police keep shooting drug addicts.
Right. It's basically
they keep shooting pedophiles. I mean, right. This is, you know, you look at the records of people that they're shooting, and these are people that need to be constrained.
They look at the escalation and they go, no one should try to stop someone doing that. That's the way you fix the escalation, is no one stops them.
Or you talk to them and that will cause them to be fixed, because words have that much power. And the church isn't saying human words don't have that much power. It requires the Word of God. It requires the Holy Spirit to do these things. Or there has to be enough light into the society that people go, you know, the darkness flees from the light. And instead what we're saying is let's just embrace more darkness and that will work better. But we'll have people talk to them about how they shouldn't really embrace the darkness.
I mean, in the end, the Word became flesh. I mean, you know what I mean? And there's a real part of it where that's what the church is the church is the body of Christ. It is the Word made flesh in the world through the power of the Holy Spirit, that does the work of God and changes the world.
And the point here isn't to say that there aren't specific reforms that Christians should be advocating for, that, you know, people who are also saying defund the police would say, yeah, we can agree with that. That's a good compromise. The point isn't that there aren't specific things that could change. You know, maybe we'll talk about that in a future episode, you know, some practical things. What can Christians be advocating for? But the point in this episode is to say, you know, what's the worldview of how the government, the police, the society are interacting, and how the citizenry need to have a certain attitude to be able to get a complete reformation of the entire society and the entire government.
I do think there's a part of it where it's just really easy to look at the world and go, how can I change things? I saw a quote today. I think it was a Chesterton quote. He said, you know, your vote has almost no chance of changing anything. You have much greater capacity to change the world through raising your family and raising your children. And I mean, I still think you should vote. But I mean, there's this part where, I mean, he has a really valid point. There's a part of it where you have a much greater capacity to change things if you start showing hospitality to your neighbors. Get to know your neighbors. Get to know them because first of all, God tells you to love your neighbor. And part of it, he tells you to love your neighbor because you are connected together. you are part of a culture, you're part of a society, and creating these fragmented groups that have no responsibility to one another, that's not much of a society anyway.
And that's one of the big things with the police, is that you're hiring somebody to come into a place, because the reality is where most crime happens is not where police live, not because the police would, you know, because their presence somehow eliminates it. It's that they wouldn't live in those crime-ridden places. And so the reality is that it's strangers coming in. That's why they do all these things about community policing. That's why they have police walk a beat, all these things to make a connection to a community. Well, the people that live there, you're supposed to already have a connection to your community. And if there were more inherent connections in the community, then you need a lot less to pay somebody to come and make a connection in the community.
Right.
And this can happen very locally, too. This can happen on a block. This can happen on a street, where somebody just goes and says, I'm going to get to know all my neighbors. I'm going to, you know, and you can make a big difference. And there's certainly been cases in the past where substantial changes have been made in a community just because somebody said, I'm going to start getting the neighbors to know each other.
The other thing that comes to mind immediately as well is just change the way you think about your church. Change the way you, I mean, like we were talking about, is where, you know, we say that the church has a responsibility, and your first thought is, well, I hope my pastor does that, or I hope the deacons do that. Is your attitude should be, you as part of the church have a responsibility to do the work of God. And God's put you in a body, and you're part of that body, and you're primary part of the body is not to sit in a pew and soak up teaching and enjoy fellowship. It's to actually do labor for the kingdom. And so change the way you think about your church.
Which means either, you know, your church is doing something or other that you can get involved with, or if you don't see that, go talk to your pastor and say, what is the church not doing that you would really like us to do? Where, you know, what's the unrealized vision? Where is their harvest but no laborer? And
if your pastor doesn't have a vision for you, read God's word, pray, and say, God, what would you have me to do? What gifts have you given me? What skills have you given me? How can I train my children to be more useful? What things can I take and lift? Are the elderly people in your church, is someone coming and meeting with them? Is there a rest home nearby that you could go and you could sing songs and you could teach and you could read the Bible and preach to? I mean, there are things to do, and a lot of times you just literally have to open your eyes and say, God, give me something to do. God's a good Lord. He's a good father.
And we just need to recognize, too, that community's breaking down at every level, right? I mean, the phones, people feel a greater community with their Facebook friends than they do where they live. But we should see this in the church, too. When you have a 20,000 person church, that's 2,000. A city. Right. But like 20,000, some of these churches, I mean, they're cities. That's not a community. And in there, you have to find people, or you have to find a smaller church where you can actually build a community. This is part of the breakdown, is the church is doing the same breakdown that's happening in the society, is that the communities are breaking down. The churches are, instead of saying, hey, let's keep a smaller group that can actually be a body together and hold one another accountable to do these things, to help each other to do the work, it's let's listen to this very charismatic speaker speak and break down the community further. If you want to get rid of the police doing all the things the police are doing, you have to start working on building communities. And if you don't have a community in your church, that's the place to start.
I mean, churches have accepted, we were talking about how the people don't know their neighbors and don't know things, and in the city it makes it impossible to do that, and in fact it lets you live an anonymous life. And sometimes the reason for a church being, sometimes the appeal of a big church is that you can get lost in the crowd. I mean, I think there was a study that was talking about groups. I thought it said around 200 was about as large. I mean, the number of people in about 200, 250 people is about as large
as
you can get.
That's been my experience, is about 200.
And have that, you know, where the number of connections that exist there, they're at a manageable level where you can actually have a relationship, where you can have connection. You get much above that, and it's almost impossible for you to have real, sustainable connections.
Right, especially within each other, right? There can be a leader, there can be a pastor that can
right.
have connections to more because he has more time. It's more of a focus of his life to do that. But the connections between the various people break down. And that's what you have to have a community, is you have to have the connections between the various people. I mean, the other thing that happens when you have police that are coming in that are from outside the community, and they kind of bring them in to be part of the community, is the community that they feel like they're part of is actually not with the people they're policing. They're their community is with the other police officers.
Right.
And the problem that happens is then police officers start to protect other police officers. And they start to, you know, and then you get even a further disparity where the law is creating some disparity. You get a further disparity that, I mean, we all know police officers will overlook things that other police officers do, you know, like speeding or things like that. They're not going to pull in another police officer for speeding.
Right.
I remember when the governor of Pennsylvania was driving and his state patrolman was driving, you know, 75 or 80 miles an hour down the turnpike in a person, I'm not sure how he didn't recognize that it was the governor's car, but he pulls him over and he starts to ticket him. And the guy says, I'm a police officer. And the policeman's like, oh, I won't ticket you then. And then Thornburg, who was the governor, said, no, you are going to give him a ticket. But that's very, 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 very rare that anything like that would happen. Usually the police officer goes, oh, you're a policeman. That's fine. And lets them go. So they create this community that creates an even greater disparity. And this is how you get corruption. And this we should expect to see corruption because This is what we're putting them in the position of, is that these are the people that they're connected to. These are the people that they have to protect one another's life. And, you know, you look at Serpico and what happened in New York City and the corruption there. I mean, this is what it comes down to is, hey, you don't cover this up. And next time that you're in trouble, we're just all going to leave.
Right. I mean, basically, there's a part of it where there's also that dissonance between you make them deal with things that you're not willing to deal with. That, you know, it,
right.
If you were them, I mean, it would be really hard not to do what they're doing. That's, I mean, every time I look at it, and that's what bothers me really fundamentally about the attacks on the police is, in most cases, the police are, anybody who was put in the position they were would be doing what they are doing. And it doesn't excuse it. It doesn't make it right. But it's really hard to look at them and not be hypocritical and say, oh, if I was in that situation, I wouldn't behave that way. I think you'd behave that way really, really quickly.
Though it does depend a lot on the example because, I mean, there's a wide variety of stuff that's been criticized. Some stuff is absolutely wicked and other stuff is, well, they're in a really hard situation and they have a bunch of bad options.
So as we consider what's happening in policing, it really is reflection on what's happening in the church and the breakdown of community in the church and the breakdown of responsibility in the church. And just as we can look at this and see where it's coming from, that also tells us where the solution is. The solution is to build community in your church, hold one another accountable, serve your neighbor. And from this, we can start to show there is another way. Right now, the society doesn't see any other way. But God in his word has instructed us in another way. And if we obey it, we should just sit back and see what God will do. Because God will bless obedience. Thank you for joining us.
This has been The Conquering Truth, a project of Reformation Baptist Church. If you found this helpful, you can visit us online at theconqueringtruth.com. And subscribe here or in your favorite podcast app. Thanks for watching.